Saga Egmont presents The Boathouse Murders by Pauline Rowson. Read by Andrew Scarborough. Chapter 1. Friday, the 19th of October.
Good result. Tim Shearer, the lean and dapper Chief Crown Prosecutor, addressed Andy Horton outside the courtroom on the Isle of Wight.
Would have been better if they'd pleaded guilty to begin with instead of wasting everyone's time, Horton replied.
Shearer nodded in agreement.
I'd give you a lift back to the ferry, only I'm staying over to discuss a couple of other cases.
And thankfully they weren't Horton's. The Isle of Wight was not his patch.
That was under the control of the acerbic stick insect DCI Birch, who was currently off sick following a hernia operation, and his fat sergeant DS Norris. But a robbery from Northwood Abbey on the northern coast of the island at the end of June had resulted in the villains being caught by Horton and Sergeant Cantelli as they were trying to sell the stuff on in Portsmouth, 5 miles across the Solent at the beginning of July. And that was his patch. The thieves, Jamie Maidment and Lewis Forland, had been advised by their solicitor to plead not guilty, but thankfully they had now seen the light, though not before going to the Crown Court and a jury being sworn in.
Horton told Shearer he had his Harley. As he collected his leather biking jacket and helmet from the witness waiting room, he thought what a breath of fresh air the new CCP was. The last one had been counting the days until his retirement and had become disillusioned with the criminal justice system. Not that Horton blamed him for that. He often despaired of it himself. But Shearer was clever, cooperative and keen. He'd recently arrived from London and had told Horton that the loss of his wife, killed in a car accident, had prompted him to make a fresh start in a city where not every street, shop and restaurant would remind him of his Jenny. It was the same name as Horton's mother, except he always thought of her as Jennifer. And while once he tried very hard to obliterate all memory of the woman who had abandoned him at the age of 10 to the mercy of children's and foster homes, now he thought of her constantly, or rather as frequently as his workload permitted. The change of heart had come about as a result of a case in December when he discovered that her disappearance just over 30 years ago was not because she had got sick of having a kid in tow and had run off with a man, but because someone had wanted her to vanish. He didn't yet know why or what had happened to her, but he was getting closer to discovering the truth. The October sky was overcast, threatening rain, and a brisk chilly wind had sprung up. In the blustering gales, Horton caught the smell of the sea coming off the River Medina, which fed down to Cowes and into the Solent. He headed out of Newport on the Harley and made for the Abbey, pleased for once to be able to deliver good news and relieved to get out of the stuffy, overheated courts. Even stopping off at the Abbey, he would easily make the 1 o'clock sailing to Portsmouth, which would get him back to his office by about 2. Time enough to clear up some paperwork and see what else had come in over the last few days while he'd been preoccupied with this case. But as the houses gave way to fields, he sensed in himself a reluctance to head straight for the Abbey. There was somewhere en route that he wanted to see. There would be another sailing at 1:30 and again at 2 o'clock. Cantelli was more than capable of handling anything that had cropped up, and if it was urgent, the sergeant would have rung him, or their boss, DCI Lorraine Bliss, would have been squawking down the line at him. He indicated off the main road and turned onto a narrow and deserted country lane. Perhaps it was reading that newspaper article while waiting to be called into court that had made him think of Lord Ames, who, it was reported, was leading a trade delegation to Russia. Or perhaps it was the fact that one of the stolen items recovered from Jamie Maidment and Lewis Forland had been a wrought iron weather vane made by the famous sculptor Albert Trostley and donated to the Abbey by Lord Richard Ames, one of the Abbey's generous benefactors. But Horton didn't need any article to conjure up thoughts of the trim and aloof aristocrat. Since meeting him in August, he'd mentally replayed the conversation that had taken place between them in the exclusive Castle Hill Yacht Club in Cowes. Ames had denied any involvement in Jennifer's disappearance, but Horton didn't believe him. Getting proof of that, though, was another matter. And he didn't think he'd find it at Ames' Isle of Wight holiday property, which was where he was heading. He pulled up at a junction by a small copse and withdrew an ordnance survey map from the inside of his jacket. After consulting it and putting it back, he swung right, heading towards the sea. The lane was narrower now, barely wide enough for one car to pass. The trees hadn't yet lost their foliage and the leaves were deepening to a blaze of red and gold.
Soon the tarmac road gave way to a gravel.